David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news. Dave, I know one of the stories is about what may be the earliest pornography. A new archaeological find?
This story, Rob, is about a tiny ivory statuette that was found just outside of Stuttgart, Germany. And the statuette, what's unusual about the statuette is it's a female figurine. The breasts are very large, and there's also a dramatically enlarged vulva on the statue. You can actually see a picture of this on the site.
And so we'll know it when we see it. As U.S. Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart said of pornography, it's pornography, not art.
Well, let's get to that in a second. But first, let's talk about how old the statue is. It seems to be at least 35,000 years old, and this is based on radiocarbon dating of some of the things the statue was found near in this limestone cave outside of Stuttgart. And what's important about that date is modern humans are thought to have arrived in Europe only about 40,000 years ago. So what it suggests is that, first of all, is that this is one of the oldest statuettes ever found, ever. But what's even almost more important is that this date of around 35,000 years old puts it very close to when modern humans first came into Europe. And what that means is that one of the first things modern humans started doing was making art, which would be a really important conclusion because there's been a lot of speculation. These humans were living around the same time as Neanderthals, and if they were making art very early, it would suggest that these humans were very cognitively advanced right off the bat when they got into Europe. And there's been a hypothesis that the reason Neanderthals disappeared is because they were basically outsmarted by modern humans. So there's a lot of implications for this find.
So they used radiocarbon dating for this, and this is the only thing that they found in this cave that's this old?
Well, they did use radiocarbon dating, but they didn't actually date the object directly. What they did was they sort of looked at the sedimentary layer that this object was found at in the cave, and they dated other objects that were found in that layer. And doing that, they estimated a date of about 35,000 years old. But this isn't the only artifact that's been found in this cave. In fact, the same team has found small figurines of animals, and even a mysterious half-man, half-lion statuette. But this is the oldest artifact they found so far, and this is the oldest statuette ever found of a human female figure.
Now, art versus pornography. What was this figurine used for?
Well, that's a good question, and nobody really knows. There have been other figurines like this found before. One of the most famous is called the Venus of Willendorf, which is dated to about 25,000 years ago and was found in nearby Austria. But, you know, even though researchers have found a few of these artifacts, and they also found other sexual representations like vulva drawn into rocks and phallic symbols carved out of bison horn, scientists really don't know what the purpose of these objects was. One suggestion is they had some sort of religious purpose. They were maybe used in shamanistic rituals. But there's also the possibility that this was just porn, plain and simple.
Okay. So what other stories have you brought with you today?
Well, Rob, speaking of ancient humans, this next story is about a tribe of people in Ecuador that live a lifestyle that's probably not too much different from the lifestyle our European ancestors lived. This is a tribe of hunter-gatherers that lives near the Napo River, close to where the Andes Mountains and the Amazon Basin meet. And what's interesting about these people, who are called the Warani, is they're one of the most homicidal tribes that's ever been studied. And the reason they're so homicidal is because they're preoccupied with revenge.
From previous killings? Is this a never-ending cycle?
Exactly. It's sort of a vicious cycle going on here. What happens is the Warani men, from a very early age, are encouraged to be very aggressive. And they go out on these raids and they kill other Warani. And what happens is these other Warani, as you would expect, the family members of those that are killed, they want to avenge these deaths. So these family members come back and kill the attackers in the first place. And what really keeps the cycle going is the tribe is constantly telling these stories about these attacks and the revenge killings and the revenge killings. And so there's this almost never-ending cycle of violence going on with this tribe. Half of all Warani die a violent death. This is how homicidal this culture was. And I say was because actually the tribe has calmed down a little bit.
Did they have their own Romeo and Juliet story?
Unfortunately, it's not that romantic. Christian missionaries came to the region in the late 1950s. And ever since then, it appears that there's been a lot less killing. This study, though, concerns a period when they were still very homicidal.
So what did the researchers look at besides the incidences of homicide?
Well, what the researchers are really interested in is the following question. Does this homicidal activity confer some sort of evolutionary advantage? In other words, if you're a very powerful warrior and you kill a lot of other people, does that give you high status in your tribe, which would in effect give you more wives, which would in turn give you more children? So is there an evolutionary advantage to being so murderous because you're going to in effect build this very large family and pass on your genes to a bunch of offspring versus if you were, say, more mild-mannered?
It sounds like the most murderous ones, because of this preoccupation with revenge, would potentially lose more of their children as a result.
Well, and that's exactly what this team found. And what they did was they looked at the life histories of about 95 warriors in this tribe, and they separated these warriors into two groups, what they called an aggressive group and a non-aggressive group. And the aggressive warriors were the ones that participated in more than 4 raids during their lifetimes. And these raids were obviously when all the killing was happening. And when the researchers compared these quote-unquote more aggressive warriors to less aggressive warriors, what they found is both groups of men had about the same number of wives and the same number of children. So that was the first knock against this theory that if you're more homicidal, you have more wives and children. But even more interesting was the fact that the more aggressive warriors had more children die before they reached age 15. And this is the age, you know, around when puberty begins.
Because of these raids.
Because of the revenge killings. You know, they would go out, the men would go out on these raids, kill a bunch of people.
Including children.
Including children. And these people would come back and kill their children. So the more aggressive you were, the more likely your kids were going to get killed. And from an evolutionary standpoint, this is obviously a very bad thing because you're not passing on your genes if all of your children are dying.
So nice guys finish first.
At least evolutionary-wise.
Okay, and I see you've got one more story with you. What's this one about?
Well, this is something completely different, Rob. This is a story about neutron stars. And neutron stars are among the densest objects in the entire universe.
Because they're left over after a supernova?
Exactly. Neutron stars form when you have this giant star. And what keeps, you know, the stars so big is that they're able to exert so much energy. I mean, think about all the energy our sun is pushing out. But as a star gets older, it no longer has the fuel to support these massive outbursts of energy. And what happens is the star essentially collapses under its own weight. And with a neutron star, the core of the star collapses into the size of an asteroid. So you think of something as massive as the core of a star collapsing into an object as relatively tiny as something the size of an asteroid, and you can just get a sense of the densities we're talking about here. In fact, the calculations suggest that the stars weigh as much as 90 million metric tons per teaspoon. So imagine having a teaspoon that had 90 million metric tons of material in it. I mean, we're talking extremely dense objects. But nobody had looked at how strong these neutron stars were before, or at least how strong their crust was. You would imagine it would be very strong because the material is so dense, but nobody had measured it before.
And obviously, we don't have a neutron star around here. So how did scientists measure this?
Well, they ran supercomputer simulations, and they fed in all the data they have about neutron stars. And what they found was that the material in the star's crust is at least 10 billion times stronger than the toughest steel.
Okay, very interesting. But why does it matter?
Well, this strength of this crust really explains how neutron stars keep it together, as it were. These neutron stars still pack a lot of energy, and they can release this energy every once in a while in the form of gamma ray bursts, which are some of the most powerful explosions in the universe. So the idea is that the crust has to be very strong to contain all of this energy. But the researchers also found something else interesting. When these neutron stars form, they never form a perfect sphere. And what happens is they get these bumps on their surface. And when I say bumps, these bumps weigh as much as the entire Earth weighs. So these are very dense, very heavy bumps. And neutron stars spin very, very fast. And as these neutron stars spin, these bumps actually are so dense, the bumps create gravity waves. They're actually distorting space-time itself.
At least in these simulations.
At least in the simulations. And, you know, at the end of the day, knowing all this stuff, it makes it easier to study phenomena like gravity waves and even neutron stars and gamma ray bursts if we know more about how these things form in the first place and, you know, more about the mechanics involved, it makes it easier to, first of all, spot this stuff in the universe and understand it a little better.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into stories about how flowers help bees get a grip on them. And also, speaking of flowers, also solving the mystery of how plants survived so close to the Chernobyl accident. And on the Science Insider blog, we're continuing our daily coverage of swine flu. This week, we've got an exclusive interview with CDC's flu chief. And we're also looking at a bunch of non-flu news. Earlier this week, we reported on one of the Mars rover Spirit that looks like it may be near the end of its life and what that means for future studies of the red planet. So be sure to check out those stories and the Science Now items on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.